Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The clock is ticking for European politicians. With the future of the euro in the balance, they need to come up with a plan to shore up the shaky finances of some European governments and banks. So far, there's no deal. Joining me to talk about Europe's political paralysis, Zanny Minton-Beddoes of The Economist, Sadeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal, Marcus Zehner of Handelsblatt, a German daily, and Antonio Delithia from the delegation of the European Union to the United States. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. Join us by phone, by email, on Facebook, or Twitter. Good morning and welcome to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Zanny, if I could start with you, the European politicians certainly not unlike what seems to be happening here seem to be behind the curve on this one. Give us an idea of where we are right now.
I think behind the curve is an understatement, if anything. Throughout this crisis, which is now, almost 2 years old, too little has been done too late to solve it. And as a result, what began as a fiscal crisis in Greece, a country worth 3% of the eurozone's GDP, has now transformed into a crisis that threatens the whole eurozone. But I think there are two specific areas where action needs to be taken and decisions need to be made. The first one is on Greece itself. And the sort of narrow question of the moment is, will the European Union's politicians decide to give more rescue loans to Greece to enable it to avoid a kind of chaotic default on its debts within the next few weeks? By the middle of October, Greece is basically going to run out of money and there's going to be a chaotic default unless there is more money coming, more rescue funds. And so far, the Europeans have been playing hardball, particularly the Germans. They have wanted more signs of more measures from the Greeks before they do it. So that's the immediate thing. And just very briefly, the broader problem, however, is that it's no longer just about Greece. It's a crisis that has metastasized much further than that. And the particular new wrinkle, if you will, since we last spoke about this, is that big economies in the heart of Europe, particularly economies like Italy, have been hit with essentially a crisis of confidence where investors worry about whether they too may be forced to default. And as a result, there's a loss of confidence in their bonds. People are not willing to buy them. And the big question for the Europeans, the broader question, is what are they going to do to deal with that? Are they going to provide resources? Is the European Central Bank going to get involved more? How are they going to do that broader solving?
Sadeep Reddy, what kinds of changes has Greece made up to now?
Greece has made a lot of promises so far. They've promised to raise taxes on citizens, particularly the wealthy. They've promised and actually taken some job cuts and benefit cuts. They just haven't done enough, and that's the problem. We keep getting to this point where there's another review every few months and find that Greece has done some things but just hasn't taken the decisive action, the complete action that either it promised or it suggested to the European leaders and leaders from the rest of the world that it would do. And that's why there's this crisis of faith now that Greece will actually be able to come through, because so far everything has fallen short and they do really seem to be a step behind in Europe in trying to at least enforce the commitments that Greece has made.
But Marcus Reddy, as Zanny has said, other European countries, other banks are very much in trouble as well.
Yeah, that's right. But I think you have to take a case-by-case approach. I'm not convinced that actually the whole eurozone is in jeopardy. If you look at what's happening in Ireland, what's happening in Portugal or in Spain, Ireland is improving, Spain is improving, and Portugal has adopted or is going to adopt a pretty severe austerity program. So I'm not so sure that whether we are going to see, or whether we are in the middle actually of a big euro crisis. I think it's a crisis of some euro countries. I think we have to buy time, and that's what the European leadership is actually about doing. They want to buy time, but not only for Greece. They want to buy time for these countries I just mentioned to be able to weather a storm that might be ignited by a Greece default. So that's what buying time is about right now.
So you're saying that the problem is with some euro countries, but not with all of Europe?
Yes. We have to admit that the mechanism is not in place actually to deal with situations like in Greece. The European leadership was too slow in adopting these kind of mechanisms. They are just starting to doing that. We are going to have a bailout fund in October. We might be having a European stability mechanism in 2013. So we're pretty slow. The Europeans are pretty slow, actually, in getting ready for this.
Why do you think they're so slow?
Because they haven't envisioned it. I just think that they glossed over a couple of things. I mean, and that's also true for the German government when they were permitting the Greeks to join the Eurozone. I think it was already obvious way back then that Greece has quite some problems. But they just turned a blind eye to that.
And to you, Antonio De Letha, what are EU leaders pushing for now?
Right. If I may, I would like to slightly disagree with some of these statements so
All
far.
Right.
I mean that Europe needs a plan to shore up finances in some EU members. Well, the plan is there, and the plan has been identified. The decisions have been agreed. The point is to implement them. So that's the main point. And why they have not been implemented? Because I mean we are in democratic countries, and maybe the expectations are too high of too quick decisions. I mean, we'd rather have the populations with us than being faced with problems right after. I mean, taking the decisions and then show that those decisions cannot be implemented. So the benchmark by which, often in the media, we hear that we are too slow or too fast. The timing of the media and the financial markets is not necessarily the same as with democratic countries.
But are you saying that the media is portraying this situation as being far worse than it really is?
The situation is serious. And it is serious partly because the financial markets also expect quicker reaction. And in the meantime, well, they don't no longer provide the funding, which aggravates the problem. So it's and they don't because they in some way don't trust or mistrust the capacity to deliver.
So, but isn't time of the essence at this point, as this whole situation seems to be spiraling into worse and worse situation?
Indeed, time is of the essence, and delivery is of the essence. And for that, all parties need to act. And Greece must, clearly show that they are ready to do whatever it takes, which is painful, but it's what they had already, they already needed to do long ago. And now they can do it with the help of the EU and the international community.
But would you agree with Sidi Breti that Greece has already taken some steps?
Indeed.
But you're saying not enough.
Indeed, absolutely.
Zani?
It seems to me that the fact that financial markets don't believe in what's going on is prima facie evidence that this strategy is not working. And I don't think you can fall back and say, well, the media don't understand and the financial markets don't understand. If the financial markets don't understand, then the strategy is not working. But secondly, I think there are two important misconceptions in the European response. The first is, and I think this is very much a German-driven thing, the view is that the cause of this crisis was profligate, particularly Mediterranean governments, and the right response is austerity, short-term budget cutting. That is absolutely true in the case of Greece. I would submit that it is not necessarily the main or indeed the major cause of the problem in a country like Italy or in Spain or indeed in Ireland. Ireland and Spain were running budget surpluses before the financial crash. Their sovereigns are in trouble because they had a big property bust and a banking crisis. So the kind of very simplistic notion that this is all about government spending and too much profligacy is wrong. Secondly, I think the more you push on austerity in the short term, the worse your economy is and the harder it makes it to reach your targets. And that's exactly what's happened in Greece. The economy is in a depression. It's not surprising that it's unable to cut its deficit in the way that people expected. And thirdly and finally, I think that that analysis really misses one important aspect, which is that many investors, many financial markets think that we are now in a very different world to the one that they thought the whole euro project was based on. For 10 years, even though officially the euro was no bailout of individual countries, financial markets and the whole financial regulatory structure implied that all government debt ought to be treated reasonably equally. And suddenly, thanks in part to the way that the Europeans have handled this crisis, there's a lot of uncertainty about whether countries will be allowed to default. Big countries like Italy, third biggest bond market in the world. If you think that Italy might default and you used to think there was no chance of it, you're not going to want to invest in Italy. And that's a kind of fundamental big question of confidence that the Europeans need to address.
Sadiq.
When people look at this problem, they see Greece, they see protests on the street in Greece and often forget the linkages throughout financial markets around the world. And that's really the problem that we're facing now. If this were just a Greece problem, obviously it wouldn't be getting this much attention. And the issue is how much financial markets actually believe the policymakers. Policymakers over the last 3 or 4 years have lost a lot of their credibility. They took important actions in the 2008 and 2009 financial crisis. And it may have actually saved the world, but now they're straining to present to investors that they can actually accomplish something more. Now they're low on ammunition. Their tools just aren't as good as they were before, and that's the really big problem now.
Said Brad, he's economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. 800-433-8850. That's the number to call if you'd like to join us. Send us an email to drshow.org. Welcome back. As we talk about the European debt crisis, its effects not only on Greece, but on the entire Eurozone, potentially. Here in the studio, Sadiq Reddy, economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal, Marcus Zehner, U.S. correspondent for the German daily Handelsblatt, Antonio Delithia, he's Minister for Economic and Financial Affairs from the delegation of the European Union to the U.S., Zanny Minton-Betto, she's economics editor at The Economist. I look forward to hearing your questions, your comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Marcus Zehner, it would seem that Germany is certainly playing a huge role in this entire discussion.
Absolutely. If we're talking about the bailout fund, for instance, it's Germany is in, is actually shouldering half of the fund. So in case Greece goes badly, so the Germans will have to pay quite a bit.
And the German people are not too happy about that.
Yes, and I wanted to come back to that because sure, the media might distort a little bit the overall image, and that could be seen last night when we had the elections in Berlin, local elections. And the interesting part was that the one party that was openly more or less campaigning against Greece, they lost severely, and they didn't made it into the parliament, into the local parliament of Berlin. And that's basically good news, because it shows that you can't really benefit too much from such a policy, from such a campaign. The bad news is, the party I'm talking about is the junior coalition partner of Angela Merkel's grand coalition. So in a way, that's good and bad at the same time. It might be such that the German public already very much understands what Greece is about, and that they must be helped.
Europe is demanding that Greece really cut back, and some people are wondering whether that kind of austerity is simply going to take Greece further down. Antonio.
Well, this is only partly true. What Euro demands is indeed that that Greece reigns in its deficit, which is unsustainable in any case. But what Europe also wants is that Greece unleashes the growth potential that is now really locked by a number of regulations, by distortions to competition, by a bloated public sector. So this is as important as reigning in public finances. This is the biggest or one of the main parts and parcels of the package. So what Greece is requested is indeed to cut the deficit, but also to implement all those reforms that will unleash the growth, that will make Greece grow, and therefore be able to pay the debt, but also to grow and create income.
Marcus Senior.
Yeah, I wanted to just to clarify that it's not as simplistic as one might think, that Germans only saying, well, we need an austerity program and then things will go fine. I mean, that's not the case. But Greece has already $350 billion of debt. I mean, the question is whether it's a good idea to pile up more debt, and they will have to deal with that. So that's one thing. I think it's not only about cutting tightening the belt. That's it's more than that.
Zanny.
I think it's an irony that the one country which, according to most observers, will not be able to pay its debt, which is Greece, which is really a pretty, by most dispassionate people looking at this, think Greece is insolvent and that there is no way they can possibly pay their debt burden. Yet for Greece, the Europeans insist on pretending that it will be able to if it does enough austerity. And then there are other countries, I'm using Italy as an example, but many of the other ones, where probably they are more illiquid than insolvent, but the Europeans are refusing to kind of stand clearly behind them. So I think part of the problem this whole crisis has got so much more complicated is that in neither case are the Europeans prepared to say clearly, you know, what side of the fence the country is on. And I think in Greece's case, it's very, very hard to see that Greece will be able to pay its current debt burden. And so it will either require open-ended transfers from the rest of the European Union, or there will need to be a hard restructuring of Greece's debt that involves cutting the debt burden. Now, that doesn't mean a kind of chaotic default. You could do it in an organized way. But the Europeans have been pretending that there's some middle way that Greece, if it does enough budget tightening and growth-enhancing reforms, which are very important, but if they did those, it would be able to pay its debt burden. And I just don't believe it possibly can, and I think this would be helped by some clarity there.
Well, Zanny is exactly right here, because there are really two extremes of what you can do here. One is to deal decisively with Greece and with the weaker members, whether it involves a restructuring of their debt or some other decisive action, perhaps even figuring out a way to throw them out. Or at the other end, you can actually create a stronger fiscal union in Europe. The Eurozone was set up with a common central bank, but no common government to deal with budgets. And this is actually an opportunity to move in that direction. The problem, of course, is that they're dealing with 17 governments. And we know in the United States how difficult it is to deal with one, but to get 17 together in the room simultaneously to all move on the same track, especially when they all have incredibly different histories and political and economic environments, that is a really tough task. And that's why so many investors really don't believe this is going to end well, because it's just politically an incredibly messy problem to deal with.
So does all this come down to the question of European integration, whether the euro was somehow missold or oversold? How do you see it?
Well, that's certainly the big question. The grand project here was to force Europe to come together and to create stronger ties. And now you're seeing these divisions, you're seeing the resentment between countries. So I actually think the top political leadership in most of these countries, particularly in Germany and France, they understand that they need to come together and form, over the longer run, a stronger union. The problem is getting a lot of the political authorities, particularly at the lower levels, to see that this is the issue. Because the leadership, whether it's the heads of state or central bankers or finance ministers, they can see how this will unravel, and they know what the long-run game is, but they have to deal with the day-to-day politics of it as well.
Marcus, do many in Germany regard the whole euro as a bad idea in the first place?
Not at all, not anymore at least. I mean, at the beginning, sure, there was the feeling that the German market was the better deal, but then it turned out that the euro is a pretty hard currency. So I think there are no regrets, and I think they're seeing all the advantages you have from a united European currency. You can you have no exchange rate risk. You can freely trade within the European Union. It's much easier. But there is a political component to all that, and that seems to me is coming a little short here. If you look at the history, European integration after World War II, I mean, step by step, this integration was getting much closer and tighter. And the former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, he once said that it's a question of war and peace when he was talking about the euro. It might be a little overblown, but in the end, there's some truth to that.
We have an email from Barty in Naples, Florida. He says, U.S. Secretary Treasury of the Treasury, Geithner, is giving the Eurozone money from the U.S. Treasury to keep them open for business in the guise of short-term loans backed solely by euros. If the euro goes because of this crisis and confidence flees, the American taxpayer could be on the hook for it. The U.S. government is conducting another bailout, Sadiq.
Well, the U.S. government certainly is involved, but largely through the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, which is a partner in the rescues of several of these countries and is acting as an enforcer in Greece and Portugal and Ireland. And that's actually the U.S. has about a sixth of the IMF in terms of the power there. And that's a useful way, given the constraints both economically and politically here at home, for the U.S. to be involved in that. The Treasury Secretary realizes, having lived through not only the 2008 financial crisis, but he was a senior Treasury official in the 1990s and dealt with the crises in Mexico and Russia and South Korea. And he knows how these things, these crises develop, and knows that you need to bring firepower. But U.S. credibility is clearly strained here in sending a message to the Europeans. We not only created the financial crisis and exported it abroad, but also after the events of the summer in this ridiculous debt crisis at home, policymakers around the world are not looking to the U.S. for political guidance and wisdom here, because they can see that we're just as troubled here
so
as a lot of other places.
When the Treasury Secretary went to Europe and presented his ideas, I gather there was not the warmest reception. Antonio.
That's not fully correct. Secretary Geithner was invited because there is, I mean, the The various economies are now very much intertwined, and this is the acknowledgement that one cannot solve the problem in one part of the world only, because financial stability can be a problem.
You're
everywhere.
Being very diplomatic.
But it goes both ways. It happened, or it could have happened with the U.S. debt or the U.S. default, that we would have suffered from it, and vice versa. So, and the acknowledgement of that is that he was invited. So then Secretary Geithner exposed his views. He was very much and very very carefully and attentively listened to. We benefit from his experience, and of course we will factor that into our own decision making and our ideas.
Was it really necessary for the secretary to be at the meeting in Wrocław in Poland? I don't think so. Actually, he was invited by Poland. Okay, so he couldn't reject that. But he was a week earlier. He was in Marseille attending the G7 meeting, and I think he already said what he wanted to say. And was it very wise of the secretary to talk about Lehman Brothers not having quite, so to say, a second Lehman Brothers in if you compare that to Greece, openly on television? I don't know whether that was helpful. I think we've learned that markets are very sensitive, and you should be careful what to say.
Zanny.
I think there's several things going on here. First of all, I think it's absolutely true that U.S. credibility internationally is somewhat compromised by the absurd political shenanigans that went on here during the summer.
You're talking about
the debate about raising the debt ceiling. The very real risk, it appeared, that the U.S. was going to default really did lead around the world to enormous raising of eyebrows of what on earth is going on in this country. You know, who on earth runs this country? This place is chaos. And I think as a result, you know, it's much harder for U.S. policymakers to go and say with credibility, this is a very serious crisis. I'm now talking about the Eurozone. This is for the U.S. to say this is a very serious crisis. You need to act. You need to act big time. So I absolutely accept that. Nonetheless, I think that it was, Secretary Geithner had to go because he was invited by the Poles. You couldn't possibly, it would be hard to turn down an invitation. And I think it was having gone, it was perfectly sensible and reasonable for the U.S. to lay out the stakes involved. And I think there is a sense in Europe of not really recognizing the short-term stakes. And people scoff at this Lehman moment comparison. But it is true that financial markets, the consequences of a mishandling of the European crisis could be extremely grave for the Europeans and for the world economy as a whole, and it's already pretty weak shape.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Carrie in North Carolina. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah. A really interesting topic. I'm not an economist. I've got this simplistic idea that the problem is that all these countries have their currencies linked together. They used to float. And I was wondering if something as simple as sort of creating, you know, reinstating sort of their old currencies and have those individual currencies float against the euro, have a new lira and a new mark and a new franc, and have those things float against the euro. And then one of the problems it seems to me is that there's no way that they can devalue the currency because it'll mess everything up. But I think in this way, these individual countries could have kind of their own exchange rate.
All right, sorry. Thanks for your call, Sadiq.
Well, the old formula, the old playbook, was to devalue a currency, and it would boost exports, draw in tourism, do all sorts of things that would allow a country to recover through that massive devaluation. To do that now would be one extreme of what you could do in solving this problem, but that would essentially be the breakup of the Eurozone if you're going to move away from a single shared currency and move back to individual currencies. It is an approach. Nobody is really prepared to discuss it right now because it would be ugly, and you have to figure out how to deal with the banking systems in different countries that all have debt from each other on their books, and they all have the existing currency. But once you get beyond that stage, you then deal with the issue of the crisis in financial markets that would occur just by raising the idea, and then you're just creating the problem that you're trying to avoid.
Marcus, how do you see it?
Yeah, Sadiq's right. I mean, in the past, many of the European countries were able to devalue their way out of trouble, and that's not a possibility anymore. And it seems to me that European leaders only now they understood that being in a currency union means that you have to stick to what you agreed upon. So in a way, you don't have that tool anymore, which makes it difficult for countries like Greece and others to adhere to what they agreed on. So
all right. Let's go to Arthur in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I've been listening to a very interesting discussion of economic strategies and the future of the euro and of the European Union. But far below all of this, or off to the side, are the Greek people who seem to be suffering a great deal. And they're being asked to suffer a great deal more. And what are they going to have to give up? And what is the future for them? Unemployment is bad. It's getting worse. I understand that the Greek government is being asked to set aside or lay off hundreds of thousands of workers.
All right, sir, let's get a response, Zanny.
Well, I have a lot of sympathy with the caller's view. I think it is quite clear that the Greek government, the Greek economy is in an absolute depths of a recession that shows no sign of ending anytime soon. The truth, however, is that the Greek government was spending much, much more than it was raising for a very long time, and that couldn't go on. So what is needed is a combination of some tightening and particularly a cutting of the government, but then, I think as Marcus said earlier, a lot of reforms designed to overhaul the economy and make it grow faster.
Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
James Garfield became president with great hopes and ideals. He was dead within 4 months. New revelations about how he really died. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. We'll go right to the phones, 800-433-8850, to Miguel in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes. Go right ahead, sir.
Okay. It's me. I just wanted to start. Thank you, Diane, for this wonderful show. And I just wanted to give a different perspective of the problem. I'm a young Spaniard. I just turned 30 years old yesterday. I live here in the States. And I'm a little bit tired of the media focusing on Southern European countries as the main problem of the issue. I want to remember that Germany forced the entrance of Greece in the euro, while the European Parliament and the European Central Bank said several times that they were having double accountability and that was a really bad idea. That Germany and France, in their moment, broke a law that was forcing the European countries on the euro to maintain a 3% of maximum deficit, yearly deficit, just because it was their own convenience. And that Germans are not actually the ones that are paying more per inhabitant on this crisis, that British, French, people from Luxembourg are paying more. And just to finish, I just want to say that as a young Spaniard, I'm from what they call the Ryanair generation. I cannot imagine Europe spared again. I cannot imagine Europe splitting and leaving the euro.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. And to you, Marcus Zehner.
Well, it's true. The caller's right that, as I said earlier, that many of the facts that have been available at that time, 2002, regarding Greece and other countries, have been not looked into that deeply as they should have. There was statistical data available, or at least we knew, or the European leaders knew, that the facts and the data that was available was not correct. So I think that was the kind of original sin to not be thorough enough here. But I mean, can you imagine having a eurozone without Greece when they were applying, in particular Greece, the oldest democracy? I think that was very difficult, really, to reject. And it's a question of sovereignty. I mean, you have to go to these countries and you have to look into the data. And I think 10 years ago, it was pretty difficult, actually, to get access to that and to do that.
Sadiq.
Well, the caller is making this point about the unification of Europe, the Ryanair generation. And that's why I actually think Europe is probably going to go in the direction toward greater unity in the end rather than toward a breakup. Both of them are very difficult, but the unity is at least what they've had some experience with over the past decade, and they've been moving toward that. And even for the strongest countries in Europe, Germany has seen great benefits from the euro, and they know that they want to stand behind it. And if you were to have a breakup of the eurozone, it could actually hurt pretty seriously the German economy too.
But Marcus, the question becomes exactly what will Germany support?
Germany will support the existence of the euro, and I think they very well know the dire consequences of a euro slipping away, or if even Greece having a default. We have already seen what's happened to French banks, that they've been downgraded. Societe Generale, they have a lot of exposure to Greece. Just let's imagine for a second what's going to happen if we have a default, and disorderly default. People in Greece will withdraw their money from the banks. Banks will collapse. Banks have to kind of rescued by state governments. It will have repercussions to European banks.
But the question remains, how far will Germany go to support not only Greece but the euro itself?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I really can't answer that, but I think we'll just pretend that things will go along for some more time.
And to you, Antonio.
Yes, I mean, the euro area breakout is in the interest of no one, certainly not in the interest of Germany. So at the same time, it is true that some countries, and particularly those in the southern periphery, have lived above their means for quite a few years, and they thought that the euro was in some way a substitute for good policies, and it's not. I mean, the euro by itself will not substitute bad policies, and in order to avoid that, there is the need for more surveillance and better integration, and indeed, I mean, euro area countries have agreed last weekend to go farther into in fiscal integration, so to increase surveillance, to give more teeth to the mechanisms to guide their policies and to discipline those policies.
But what about our caller's concern that there's already high unemployment in Greece, there's already strict financial control, and yet it's not enough, Zanny?
Well, I think that the last caller made a very good point when he pointed out that a decade ago it was the Germans and the French that were breaking the rules because it suited them politically. So I think
how
this
did
whole,
they break the
there
rules?
There was the Stability Pact, which had said that your deficit should be limited to 3% of GDP, and the Germans actually had a higher deficit and so got the rules kind of suspended for a while, in effect, to get away with that. So the sort of sin of breaking the rules is not only something that is done in Southern Europe. That said, and I said this earlier, I just don't think it's helpful to categorize this whole debate in terms of mistakes made by one side alone. There were mistakes made in Southern Europe, but there were also mistakes that we're now seeing in the design of the euro, in the sense that the financial regulatory structure, the incentives for banks, for governments, built up in the way that the euro was set up, were there to encourage banks to issue a lot of short-term debt, to encourage governments to issue a lot of bonds, and to make it appear that the riskiness of each bond was pretty similar. And you can say that countries were very profligate. Well, they were very profligate because they could raise a lot of money very cheaply, and the rules encouraged them to do so. So we're now, 10 years on, seeing a kind of institutional flaw in the euro, if you will, and that needs to be addressed. And I'm very encouraged by Marcus's assessment of the German population. If he's right, and I think he is, that Germany is absolutely committed to the euro, and people, the Ryanair generation, if you will, is committed to the euro. And I agree with that. I find it hard to see the euro breaking apart. But if that's a really clear political commitment, then for goodness sake, let's lay out the components of what we need to do to get there.
All right.
And that's what the Europeans are not doing.
To Brooklyn, Michigan. Good morning, Sally.
Hi. I've heard of all these problems in the world, and I just think, why doesn't the whole world start out with a zero debt? Why doesn't everybody wipe away the debt and we all start from zero? What would happen then?
What would have happened, Sadie?
Well, I certainly don't think the Chinese are going to like that with $3 trillion in foreign reserves. And countries that have actually lived within their means or handled their finances carefully are looking upon the rest now with some amusement, I think, and concern, because they have done the right things. And there are a number of countries that have done the right things, because you have an entire group of countries, Brazil, China, India, that are rising up and see very strong, bright futures ahead of them when people in the U.S. and Europe and Japan are worried about whether tomorrow will be better than today. I think the problem in a lot of this that's kind of perplexing is how much difficulty politicians have in explaining to the public and communicating to the public the core issues here. We certainly saw this in the U.S., and that's why this debt ceiling battle was so divisive. But the governments somehow need to be able to communicate more quickly to their citizens what the risks are if they don't take action, because right now the financial markets are going to act first before they have a chance to take
but
action.
But if, in fact, the politicians themselves are totally divided, it's pretty difficult to explain to a public exactly what the solution should be. Here's an email which says, isn't Greece's problem the same as the U.S., the refusal of the rich to pay their fair share of the tax burden? Zanny, how do you see it?
I think there are quite a lot of parallels between Greece and the U.S., but I think that I'm not sure about refusal to pay their fair share of taxes. I think the problem in Greece was enormous tax avoidance, that the rich, in large part, just didn't pay what they were supposed to pay. You can have a debate about whether the U.S., the rich people ought to be paying a higher share of the taxes. That's a separate debate. But in Greece, it was very much a tax avoidance was a large part of the problem and a huge amount of government spending. But I think more broadly, and this goes somewhat to the last caller's comment, one person's debt is another person's asset. And so a lot of this debate is about the distribution of losses and the distribution of pain. And I think it's at that kind of very general level, that's a question that we're going to be having in all rich countries over the next few years. But the reason that I find this whole European debate so frustrating is that I think it is being pigeonholed into a very narrow kind of definition of what the problem is. It's all Greece. It's all profligacy. And I just don't think that's true.
Antonio.
I beg to disagree. I mean, indeed, one problem is Greece. But I agree that there were loopholes in our institutional setting and that there were some incentives for some of what we have seen. But again, don't blame only the politicians. Also, markets misperceived completely the risk that was underlying in lending to Greece or to other countries. So all of a sudden, markets woke up and realized that that the risk was much higher, and that led to to freezing or to the difficulties in financing. So indeed, I mean, what we need to do now is to restore confidence, so that all Europeans can apply solidarity and can help Greece. Come out of the. Of the crisis, we need the markets to restore confidence in politicians being up to their job and making and bringing the and filling the loopholes in this institutional setting, and this certainly implies more coordination, more integration, and a stronger Europe.
Marcus,
yeah, maybe when we're talking about what to do, maybe European leaders should be more honest to the public and tell them, well, we have a problem with Greece, and Greece is 3% of the Eurozone GDP. I mean, aren't we able actually to carry them along for some more time? I don't know, 10 years, 15 years. I have no idea. I mean, in Germany we have this this burden sharing between rich lender states and poorer ones, and they all pay into one fund, and then they get the money gets distributed among them. So maybe there is a way of dealing with them with this kind of thing, but that you have to tell the public. Okay, but Greece is a hand, you can handle that problem.
Then,
you know, I completely agree that building and maintaining confidence is absolutely central right now. And I submit that there are two reasons why there's no confidence. The first is that Europe has a problem that other countries don't, which is the governance problem. Here, it's bad enough getting confidence with one treasury. Imagine when you've got 17 countries and you've got 17 finance ministers, all who feel like saying whatever they want to say, all of whom, frankly, have very loose lips and blather constantly. I don't think that helps at all. The process is very, very, very damaging in Europe. But secondly, and more fundamentally, I don't think that there is yet a collective diagnosis that is broadly laid out and made clear with a clear set of policy prescriptions. And I go back to a point I made earlier. I think the central problem is pretending that Greece is solvent when it's not. If you wanted my kind of four-point plan for the euro, I would acknowledge that Greece is insolvent and I would restructure its debts. I would then say other countries are illiquid but not insolvent and we will stand behind them. I would recapitalize Europe's banks so that they could withstand a Greek default. And I would shift the focus on from straight austerity to a much bigger pro-growth agenda.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Marcus, what do you think of that four-point plan?
Well, it's not 10 points, it's 4 points.
It's points.
Yeah, I think that sounds pretty good, but I disagree on if it comes to that the Europeans don't know what to do. I mean, they have to figure that out. I mean, you just think about the euro is 10 years old. I mean, it's pretty young, and so we're in that process of evolving. And maybe this is really the chance to get this economic government everyone is talking about. That you have to have this government in place that everyone has to adhere to. So in a way, it could be a huge
you're
chance.
You're sort of talking about joining politically as well as
absolutely.
Economically.
Absolutely.
How realistic is that possibility?
I mean, the crisis is severe, and I think governments have understood how much they can be affected if things turn out the way they as they do right now. So I think as long as this pressure is up, you should use that window of opportunity to get something done.
To create that kind of political unity, Sadiq.
Well, Diane, the strategy so far has really been a lot of kicking the can down the road, and people realize that. They've tried to buy a little time. They just haven't used the time very well to come up with decisive action. Most of the steps Europeans have taken have been actually good, but they would have been they're good solutions for what happened 3 months ago or 6 months ago, and that's the problem with trying to get political authorities together to deal with such a large problem is you can't get them on the same page early enough to send a message to markets. It's possible, and you can certainly say that markets have created some of these problems, but if investors give you enough rope to hang yourself, it doesn't mean you should go and do that. And that's what happened in the U.S. with the mortgage crisis. That's what's happened in some of these European countries with the debt crisis. And they now have to face the facts and the reality on that.
So, Zanny, suppose tomorrow, by some miraculous flip of a switch, you had created political unity within that whole area of Europe. What do you think would happen?
Do you mean political unity in terms of acknowledging what the problem is?
No.
Or broad political
absolutely.
Union.
Absolutely.
Well, see, I don't think that total political union is a necessary part of this. I think that you will, for better or for worse, call it my four-point plan. That requires more economic integration. It doesn't require full political union. I don't think you have to have full fiscal union for the Eurozone to work. I just think you need to have a closer economic integration than you've got right now and a new set of rules. But it doesn't, in my mind, require full political union. But
Marcus, last word.
You have to have some kind of law enforcement. You have to implement things, and you have to have a system to sanction the countries who don't adhere to that
Marcus
principle.
Marcus Zehnry, he's U.S. correspondent for Handelsblatt, a German daily. Antonio de Lithia, he's Minister for Economic and Financial Affairs from the delegation of the European Union to the U.S. Sadiq Reddy of the Wall Street Journal, Zanny Minton-Beddoes of The Economist. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And
thanks
for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.